I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Happy Labor Day. On this archive edition of Midday, my guest is Frank Langfitt, NPR's correspondent in London. Before he jumped into covering the hot mess that is Brexit, he spent 5 years covering China. Based in Shanghai, he devised an ingenious strategy to find out what was in the hearts and on the minds of everyday Chinese people. He gave them free cab rides. In exchange for conversations with his passengers, Langfitt ferried strangers all around China. Langfitt has chronicled the stories he collected as a taxi driver into a book called The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Our conversation was recorded earlier, so we can't take your calls and emails. Frank Langfitt joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. And before we get underway today, a big shout out to our good friends at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. We are delighted and grateful to Director Jackie Copeland and her staff for welcoming us yesterday for our conversation on reparations on Juneteenth. It will not be the last time that we do one of our remote broadcasts from the Lewis Museum, and we were just so grateful to have everybody welcome us with such open arms and delighted to have so many folks show up to be a part of that event. So thanks to everybody who was there yesterday. We very much appreciate it. So as for today, you know the voice of my guest today from his superb reporting for NPR from Great Britain. Frank Langfitt is our eyes and ears in England as the Brexit saga continues to play out. Before his assignment in London, Frank was NPR's China correspondent for 5 years in the late 90s and early aughts. Frank also covered China for the Baltimore Sun. If you listen to Frank's dispatches from China from 2011 to 2016, you may recall his occasional series called Streets of Shanghai, in which he introduced us to some of the people whom he met. Well, the way he devised to meet them is ingenious. In exchange for conversations with everyday Chinese folks, Frank offered them free cab rides, and he has compiled some of the results of these wide-ranging and revelatory conversations in a new book. It's called The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Frank Langfitt is speaking about his book at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore tonight, and I'm delighted to welcome him to Midday today. We'll take your calls a little bit later in the program. If you'd like, you can tune into the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation, and you can drop us an email to midday@wipr.org, or you can send us a tweet. Frank, welcome to the studio. It's good to see you.
Thanks for having me, Tom. It's nice to be here.
I mean, it's literally good to see you because most of the time our conversations...
We usually are talking. I'm in the London studio and we're just chatting. And also, it's great to be back in Baltimore. My mother and my wife are from here. And of course, I worked for the Baltimore Sun for 12 years.
Yeah, you are no stranger to this town.
No, not at all.
Yeah,
very familiar.
A lot of relatives. So it's great to have you back. You spent a total of 10 years
yes.
in China, partly for the Sun and partly for NPR. First of all, the book is a delight in every way.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It's insightful about China, and it's, you know, meeting the characters that you met and you introduce us to is really a fun experience. But the ingeniousness of the idea is a terrific premise for this book. Just coming up with the idea of I'll offer free rides, and in that way, I'll get to talk to people.
Well, thank you. I got the idea, actually, when I got out of college a long time ago, 1986, I couldn't actually find a job in journalism. And so I drove taxi cabs in Philadelphia, which is where I'd grown up. And I found that it was a wonderful way to get to know the city and people. And the cab, as I think we all know, is a bit of a safe space in America, wherever you go, it's an opportunity for strangers to just chat. And of course, there's a certain amount of anonymity in a taxi cab. And I found my time I got to know Philadelphia much better as a cab driver than just growing up there.
Sure.
So when I returned to China in 2011, it was clear the country was changing very rapidly. I thought, you know, what's a way to get a sense of the country from the ground up without the traditional reporting method, which is going out, finding particular people and asking them a lot of questions and sometimes kind of extracting information. This seemed a much easier way to do it.
In terms of the Chinese authorities,
yes.
you have a sort of built-in a priori suspicion of any foreign correspondent, particularly a correspondent from a rival superpower. Was this an effective way of avoiding Surveillance?
I don't know whether it was, because I had signs on my car that said it was a free taxi cab, and I must have passed tons of cops driving around Shanghai. The authorities knew exactly what I was doing, and like most reporters in China, I had people who watched me in the Ministry of State Security, and I heard secondhand that one of the agents who was watching me had been listening to the free taxi cab stories, and his response was, "Let's shut this guy." It was not, "Let's shut this guy down." He actually liked the stories. He related to the characters. And so I think I didn't have any trouble with the authorities at all. And I think part of that is that Chinese people are interested in what Chinese people think. You can't, in the streets of Baltimore, you can go out and talk to people about any topic, right? In China, you can't talk about politics openly on the street or a lot about people's lives. It's a more circumspect culture. So particularly even some of the folks or passengers are interested in reading the book because they're interested in the other people I met and hearing those stories.
The authorities heard your stories that
they
you
did.
Published on NPR. But
yeah.
Was the car bugged or something? I mean,
apartment
bugged?
No,
because you also visited people in their own homes. And
I
that
did.
Was extraordinary as well.
I did.
But
I
as
think,
you got to know them, they felt, compelled to invite you in.
Yeah, they were very kind. There was no evidence of any bugging. The way, it's a country of 1.4 billion people. So as sophisticated as the security apparatus is, they cannot keep track of everybody. And what I remember, I wasn't crossing any obvious political red lines here. I wasn't doing reporting in Xinjiang. If I'd been driving this cab in Xinjiang, I would have never gotten anywhere. But Shanghai's an enormous city. And so I didn't get a lot of scrutiny because even though I had signs on the car, in a sense, politically, I was flying under the radar. I wasn't going after any particular political issues or things like that. So they just left me alone.
I mean, people can look at you and say you're clearly not Chinese.
Clearly not Chinese.
But you are fluent in Mandarin, right?
I speak a lot of Mandarin.
So, that you were able to, it's not like you were just speaking to these folks through a translator all the time.
No, when I went out with the car initially, I would just pick up strangers and almost all the initial conversations would be in Chinese because that's what people speak. And what was interesting, Tom, is that they would get in the car and they would start interviewing me. And this, I didn't anticipate this, but it allowed the challenge in a place like China is to start off these conversations. People are sensitive. An American reporter, as you're pointing out, is not, people are always a little bit concerned. But this kind of reversed the reporting, the normal reporting narrative or paradigm, so that they felt much more comfortable and it seemed a lot more like a conversation. And then over the years, as I got to know particular people and focus on them, I mostly just let them bring up the topics that interested them and just let them guide the conversation. And if politics came up, it really came up organically. So I think they felt much more comfortable because it was what they were interested in. They brought it up when they felt like they wanted to.
You write about the differences between traditional Chinese social culture mm-hmm. and American social culture. And in China, you say you're supposed to take your time, be patient, be oblique, keep your feelings under wraps. You write about the distinctions between an acquaintance and a friend, or certainly an acquaintance and a stranger. It's different than in many parts of the United States. I mean, so that was one of the things you had to navigate.
Sure. And I think that in that particular case, I was on a rural road where I had a confrontation. I couldn't get around somebody and I got very frustrated with him and sort of lost my temper. And one of the passengers, a guy that I got to know well, Charles, in the story, just said I had, just reminded me that I had to just go much more slowly. What was, I think, really nice about this reporting process was I had years to get to know these folks. And so after a while, we became to some degree friends. And I have over 200 hours of recorded conversation. And sometimes I would go back to the conversations and looking for nuggets. And I would find the first hour was just chatting about family. I mean, it wasn't reporting at all. It was just catching up. And I really, having that time also allowed people to feel comfortable for telling me if there were certain secrets or things that had happened in their lives. It gave them 2 or 3 years to feel comfortable to tell me something that maybe they hadn't even told some of their own family members.
Yeah, and that's such a much deeper dive than meeting person, and starting asking a bunch of questions and going home and filing a story.
Yeah. That I think that made a huge difference and was a very nice opportunity.
Frank Langford joins me here in Studio A. The book is called The Shanghai Free Taxi Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. the names,
yes,
of some of the folks that you encountered are hysterical, and it's almost a terrible thing to be laughing at someone for the English name that they've chosen for themselves. But they include Morphine, Popeye, Cinderella, Billboard, Twinkle, and perhaps my favorite character in the book, if I'm allowed to pick one, a guy named Beer.
Beer.
So let's start with how folks determine what English name they'd like to.
So going back quite some time ago, young Chinese, especially when they're studying in school, will pick a Western name so that when they're communicating in English, they'll be able to relate better to a Western or an American in particular. But they don't always get the best advice. And so that's why people will often choose like very individualistic names like the ones that you've mentioned. And the one that I met, I'm interested in hearing why you like Beer so much as a character. Beer, just for our listeners, I had to buy a car. It was with my own money. I didn't want to spend a lot, so I went to a used car dealership, which seemed a logical thing at the time. The man that I met was in his early 20s from the provinces, he was a hustler and quite a schemer. And when I walked in, he immediately introduced himself as Beer. That was his English name. And it was because he liked to drink a great deal of beer, which he then recounted how much he would tend to drink at any outing, which was 7 to 8 beers. And then he essentially said, and we should go out and get hammered sometime. And this was before he'd shown me a single car. Then when I asked
him— Talk about relationship building. Yeah.
I mean, this was his kind of way of relating to people and particularly relating to a foreigner. And there were a lot of things that were very interesting about Beer, who, incidentally, I'd like to say in the end, I really liked him as a person, even though he was trying to swindle me for the first year or so of the time
yeah,
I got to know him.
He is the paradigmatic hustler, isn't he?
He was. Yeah. But he's actually, towards the end of the book, you see that he actually matures dramatically, and I was very impressed with how Beer had changed. But he also had this habit, which is very unusual. Chinese are not touchy people. They're not like Americans. They're not huggers. Beer was constantly sort of— I wore a bomber jacket when I first went to talk to him and try to find a car, and he was constantly running his hand down the bomber jacket, sometimes looking deep into my eyes, putting his hand on my knee and saying, I know you can afford this. I know you can afford this car. So it was a very strange, initial encounter with him. And he was. I kept trying to buy a car, and Beer kept trying to kind of trick me into buying something else.
Well, you know, that's not at all unlike experience of buying a car in America.
That's true.
You know, how many times have I sat across a table and someone said, can I put you in this car? Yeah. Can I put you in this? Well, no, you can't put me anywhere. I'm just, I'm here to spend more money than I'd like to. So just before we take a break, the logistics of this.
Yes.
What did the sign on your car say, and then how did people flag you down? And they had to have been somewhat suspicious of it.
Some were, and some did not get in. So what we did is we didn't know how we were going to put together a taxi. But my wife Julie had a great idea, which was to make magnetic signs. And of course, it was free, so we wouldn't be violating any law or taking business from anybody. And so in Chinese, we called it a Mianfei Aixing Che, which very loosely translated is free loving heart taxi. It sounds much better in Mandarin than it does in English.
It sort of does.
It does much better. And then we said it also in Mandarin that I was looking to make friends in Shanghai and chat about Shanghai life. Most people, I think, when they saw the signs, had a pretty good idea what I was up to. Shanghainese are smart. They also know a good deal when they see it. They really like that free in front of anything. And I think there was a certain self-selection for risk takers and very curious people. Both Shanghainese are like that. And so you ended up also with some more interesting people.
Frank Langford is NPR's London correspondent. His new book is a delight. It is a chronicle of his experiences in China, which he covered for NPR between 2011 and 2016. It's called The Shanghai Free Taxi: Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. You can join us when we come back from a quick break. We'll take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. And you can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
Thanks, Nathan. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on our program tomorrow, it's the Midday News Wrap. We'll take a look behind some of the headlines of the week's events. Plus, our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick, will review a show that she does every week for us. We will chat amiably tomorrow about Disaster at Cockpit in Court. So that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, Frank Langfitt is my guest. We're talking about his new book, The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. The book grew out of his 5 years as NPR's Shanghai correspondent. He's now based in London, and he's here with me today in Studio A. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, to follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR, and you can catch us as well on the WYPR Facebook page. So you and your wife and your family lived in Shanghai.
We did.
People like me who don't know a whole lot about China, we think about China as Beijing and Tiananmen Square, and but Shanghai is an enormous city, 24 million people. It's 2.5 times the size of New York. I mean, it's huge. And you write that it is packed full of people with enormous ambition,
yes,
and talent.
Yes.
And that there aren't enough resources,
no,
to accommodate all of
no,
that ambition and talent. That's an amazing cauldron, isn't it?
It is. I mean, a couple of things about Shanghai. I would encourage everybody. I mean, one of the things people ask me is, what would you say to Americans about China? I would say, go. Get on a plane and see it for yourself. Nothing like this has happened in human history in terms of the economic development and how much people's lives have improved in the last 20 or 30 years in terms of their livelihoods. Shanghai is such a vertical city. So to give you an example, in my neighborhood, just in the financial district, 3 of the buildings are higher than the Empire State Building. And I would say life in Shanghai, it's a very dynamic city. So if I go to Tokyo, we think of Tokyo as pretty fast-paced, or even New York. Shanghai is much more dynamic in just sort of the speed at which people are moving. That also means that with everybody competing for resources and opportunity, people bump into each other all the time. Certainly as a driver, I had to sort of maneuver very carefully through the city to avoid accidents. And there's always this sense of everybody moving with great purpose, but being careful to avoid collisions of all sorts.
You call it China's showcase city.
Absolutely.
So the authorities really want to say, hey, look, this is ours.
It is. And I think that if you take a look at Lujiazui, which is the financial district where I lived, it really looks like the Emerald City. I mean, it is a spectacular skyline. There's nothing really quite like it. And I think if you also look at the Shanghai skyline, honestly, it dwarfs Manhattan. I used to live in an apartment complex with 7 buildings that were 50 stories or higher. That's a mid-rise in Shanghai.
Seven different buildings.
I mean,
one complex.
Complex must have been, 7,000-8,000 people. And there's tons of those in Shanghai.
And over the decade, between the times you were there, the cost of living in Shanghai is enormous. $1,000 a square foot to $9,000
a square foot. Has risen dramatically. And so when I first got to China, most of my friends did not own their own apartments. These were communist, what they called work unit apartments. If they worked for the government, the government gave them an apartment, and it was pretty shabby and not very nice. Then there was a huge real estate transfer where people were allowed to buy their apartments in the late 90s for a very good deal. This was a great thing that the government did, frankly. But it meant that if you lived in the city and you worked for the government, you got this wonderful deal for real estate. But if it means you're a migrant coming in from outside, it's very hard to get on the property ladder. You don't have the same opportunities. Many of the folks that I got to know through this taxi cab are migrant workers, and I find them very dramatic, naturally very dramatic characters. They come from the provinces, they have their dreams, they come to the big glittering city and they try to make it. They often live in pretty tough circumstances, and they're often really working very hard to scrape out a living. I think you could relate to this in New York, London, other big cities around the world.
Sure. You mentioned Charles, one
yes,
of the characters.
Yes, he's a classic example.
He comes
of
from outside, and because he's not Shanghaiese, he gets to the city and he doesn't have access to things like public education or health benefits. I mean, because he's a country kid instead of a city kid.
He has some access, but not the same that he would if he'd been raised there. And there's no way. So it was really interesting. These are the people, the migrant workers are the ones who have built these incredible cities in China. And yet they have to go home at a certain point because they can't make it there. And they don't have the same kind of access to healthcare and education. So I find them very poignant characters. They're actually my favorite My favorite people in China are the ones that the people in the big cities look down on. They're the people who've come from the countryside. They're the muscle that has built the country, have built the cities, but they can never feel a part of these cities. And in the end, they must return home to the provinces.
You told us a little bit about Beer and your experience buying a used car from him. You took some folks to a wedding in the countryside.
Yes.
That was a fascinating scene.
That was really fun. So after about a year or so of driving around Shanghai, of course, keep in mind, Shanghai is about as representative of China as Manhattan is of America. It's sort of one of a kind. And so I thought it would be fun to just get out and get back out to the countryside to see what was going on. So my news assistant, his name's Yang Zhuo, his idea was that we would put out an advertisement on Weibo, which is the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, offering a ride home to the countryside for Chinese New Year, which is the largest annual mass migration. And we got two very interesting people who signed up for this. One was Charles and another guy was Rocky. They just happened to be from counties close together in Hubei province. So it was a 500-mile drive home, which is great. It was so much fun to do this road trip where you record everything and you start off, everyone's stiff and careful and censoring themselves. And by the end, they're talking very openly about everything.
You're singing together.
Yeah, it was great fun. It was a wonderful, wonderful trip. Everybody had a great time. And then when I got there, both of them were getting married to different women in their counties. And so I became the de facto wedding chauffeur. And that was particularly at Rocky's wedding. What was so fun is it was about an hour drive out to his village for the wedding. And since I had a big van, it was my job to pick up relatives along the way. And the relatives would get in the van and they would look at me, a gray-haired white guy, and say, "Who's this guy?" And they would just say, no, he's a friend of Rocky's from Shanghai. I said, okay. And then you get to the village. And this was astonishing to me, Tom. But 2015, no foreigner had ever set foot in the village before. And so it's a reminder that even as places like Shanghai are so cosmopolitan and so international, lots of small communities in rural China don't have contact with outsiders.
And it's so interesting to learn about people like Rocky, who became a lawyer in Shanghai, but this tension that he has in his own mind and with his family between his rural roots and his city circumstances.
This is fascinating. Of course, all industrial and post-industrial countries have gone through that. They've started as rural agricultural economies, and then they moved to much more urban and industrial ones. Of course, in China, that has happened in record time, which means the tensions for these folks about their values and fitting in the big city are that much more acute. And Rocky was really interesting because I remember we were up on top of his house, and he was looking around and he misses the quiet of the countryside. He misses growing up in the farmland, but he's already changed and he's already now an urbanite. And so when he comes back, he's there for 2 or 3 days, but he doesn't feel comfortable anymore. And he also knows that he could never return home there because there's nothing there for him. Most of the villages have hollowed out. It's mostly older people and very young kids. All the people of working age have moved to the cities, mostly on the coast, originally to work in factories, but now, like Rocky, has made this leap from being just a kid who grew up on a farm to being a lawyer in a big office tower in Shanghai.
And the birth rate way down in China?
Way down, of course.
It's becoming a real problem.
It actually is, and there's some of this. The book does deal with this because we do get into the one-child policy, given some of the people that I got to meet. What is astonishing about the one-child policy is that it ended up in probably the forced abortions of tens of millions of kids. Mm. These days, it's a two-child policy, and they're encouraging people to have children because the labor force isn't big enough to move this economy the way they need it to. And it's too late because it is now so expensive to raise a child, they cannot get people to have more children. And demographers that I know in China say, looking back, they never needed the one-child policy in the first place, which is a kind of a horrifying
natural
thought.
Attrition would have accomplished what they needed to do.
Just as it has in all countries that make this transition from rural to, post-industrial.
Frank Langfitt, the book is called The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. I want to talk about a character you introduce us to named Chen.
Yes.
In relation to what President Xi Jinping calls the Chinese dream, she was elected the second year you were there, the second year in the second tour of duty in China, 2013. And, are there parallels between what she was talking about with the Chinese dream and what we refer to frequently here as the American dream?
There are and not. And I think it's really interesting to look at this. So his Chinese dream is about human empowerment to some degree and about people being able to improve their living standards and have lots of opportunity. In that sense, it's very much like the American dream. The difference is he also talks about the Chinese dream as, frankly, he doesn't say it this way, but what he really means is it's the Communist Party's dream of a national rejuvenation and taking China and restoring it to its central place in geopolitics in the world. There was a period of time that they called the century of humiliation, when China was carved up by foreign powers. This was during the Civil War, World War II, going all the way back to the Opium War of 1840. He now has a vision for the nation, which is we're all going to pull together, and it's a very nationalistic vision, and we're going to make China great again. And in that sense—
Where have we heard that before?
Well, I got to say, in that sense, it is terribly familiar because Donald Trump is saying we're not where we are now today, where we should be, and we need to go back to our past greatness and then reassert and be respected worldwide. It's this exact same thing that Xi Jinping is saying. It's just one of them is Chinese and one is American, and they're both nationalists.
And it's interesting that Chen is a character who ultimately his dream is to move his family to the United States.
Yes.
There are other characters who, even if they have a lot of interaction with Americans and even spend time in America, ultimately decide to come back to China. They are disillusioned with America.
They are. And I think that this is maybe one of the most important things that I found getting to know people is that there's an old trope in some China books where Chinese people suffer repression. They're having a very, very hard time. Like Chen, actually, Chen does suffer from terrible repression by the Chinese government. They move to America and everything's great. And that's sort of how the books or sometimes the narratives end. There's one character named Ashley. Ashley, who's a very interesting person. She is the daughter of Communist Party officials. She doesn't like the corruption that has basically metastasized in the official life in China. And she wants freedom, and she moves to the United States. 5 months later, Donald Trump becomes president. She doesn't like President Trump. She begins to question the premise of American democracy, which is an informed citizenry will make the right decision, you know, most of the time. And she becomes increasingly disillusioned. She sees what happens in Charlottesville. She's horrified by that. And she starts to talk more about what she sees as the efficiency of the authoritarian system, the ability to build all those bullet trains, those huge buildings to push the economy forward. And so she has, we talk for a number of years, and it's interesting to watch the evolution of her thinking. And in the end, she does something that she never planned to do, which is she returns home to China.
Chen was a Christian, and he
yes.
actually ran an underground secret church mm-hmm. in his apartment. So religious oppression is an issue in China.
It's much worse now than even when I first met Chen. I met Chen at a Shanghai ferry stop, and because he saw the signs, he sort of assumed that maybe there was something spiritual behind those. And he asked me if I was a Christian, and I said I was, and I went to church on the other side of the river. And the next week, he invited me to his house without saying what it was about. And I walked as I was walking down the corridor to his apartment, I could hear people singing hymns. And these are illegal house churches. They run out of homes. The Chinese government has a state-controlled church. People like Chen don't believe in it. And the services are really quite lovely, Tom, because people will sing the hymns, and then they will get up, and they will just speak about how they interpret scripture and integrate it into their own lives. Since the time that I first met Chen, it has become much more repressive. The government sees particularly Christianity as a foreign religion, as a threat to its hold, its sort of its ideological hold on people, and it's become much, much worse. There was
Is Christianity singled out as opposed to Judaism or Islam?
Well, Islam's another problem, and we can get to that in another question from the Chinese government's perspective. Christianity is singled out, I think, for two reasons. One, it is Western, whereas Buddhism feels much more Eastern. It is Eastern. And the second thing with Christianity is the Chinese Communist Party sees the fall of the Soviet Union as a very cautionary tale. And the role that the Pope played in solidarity in Poland, they see that they do not want a repeat of this. They feel that they do need to learn from the history of other authoritarian regimes around the world.
We want to emphasize again that it's very unusual for Chinese people to invite foreigners into their home. So the fact that you have this kind of perspective, you have gotten to know these people over a period of years, really, I think, makes this book stand apart. I mean, the kind of reporting you're doing here is reporting that a lot of foreign reporters just don't have access.
Well, some do. I mean, I wouldn't want to overstate this. There's a lot of great reporting done. In China right now. And there are a lot of foreign reporters who have actually far better Chinese than I do. The level of Chinese and sophistication of American and Western reporters in China right now has never been higher. But I think what was helpful here is having the opportunity to do it over years. And I think the fact that maybe with the taxi cab, I offered somebody something in return for nothing else. And so they sort of felt like, oh, this is kind of nice. And people did. I mean, even I would give people rides who didn't eventually come into the book. And they would say at the end of the ride, they'd say, would you like to come to lunch? Would you like to come to dinner? And I'd say, sure. And then you never knew who you would meet at dinner.
Yeah, right. And the circle expands.
Exactly. And you just keep following the passengers and the story where it leads.
Yeah. We have a tweet from William who says, can you contrast and compare China's internal migrants and our non-documented workers?
That's a really, really good question that I hadn't thought of. I think they're, first of all, I would say that the Chinese internal migrants have more rights, certainly than people who come here are non-documented workers. But they're very similar in the sense that they are coming out of economically deprived areas. They are searching for better lives. They are at the bottom rung. They are doing jobs that, in this case, Shanghainese would never do or Americans would never do anymore in terms of landscaping here in the United States, hard construction work in China. So, yeah, there are actually a lot of...
Yeah, somebody's building those 70-story apartment buildings.
Exactly. So, actually, there's a lot of similarity there. The migrants are also looked down on, as many migrant workers here, and people who come from overseas here are sometimes looked down on as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of similarities.
You mentioned Ashley's disillusionment with corruption within the Chinese Communist Party. You note that a study by the People's Bank of China back in 2008, so this is a while ago, found that more than 16,000 Communist Party officials and CEOs had disappeared with $130 billion.
Yeah.
I mean, it was rampant. And this is something that Xi made a promise to upend.
And this is also one of the reasons he's actually very popular. I think it's important for Americans to understand that you can have an authoritarian leader who also would win an election tomorrow if they decided to hold one. When I got back in 2011, I was really shocked. The level of corruption was sort of pathological in the sense that people were stealing, as you mentioned, it wasn't a million here, a million there. It was just tremendous amounts of money, and they were getting out of the country because they didn't believe in the Communist Party. They didn't believe in the system. It was more like the mafia. I think Xi very wisely recognized that the party was, frankly, finished if he did not fix this problem. And he went in and put in the toughest anti-corruption campaign in the party's history, put more than a million people in jail, and along the way got rid of a lot of his rivals. So it was a twofer for him.
It was a twofer.
Oh, and it was from a purely political science perspective, it was a brilliant twofer. And what I found is, by maybe 2014, 2015.
But a million people.
Oh, yeah, but it's a big...
It's a big country,
Tom,
but still,
Tom,
a million people is a lot of people.
Tom, it is a big country. They made a ton of money in the expansion of global capitalism, and people were stealing with both hands.
Yeah.
So those numbers don't surprise me at all. I'm sure they're low.
I'm sure
they're low.
Yeah.
But he really won over, not only did he win over average people, but even liberals who wouldn't agree with President Xi's, some of his political policies, they were so grateful to him for doing this because it made people really, really furious.
Yeah, I had the same experience when I visited St. Petersburg, Russia, and I have not spent very much time in, overseas other than, Europe and the sort of usual places. Putin's popularity is enormous. I mean, we have this notion in America that, if only they knew, if only these poor information-deprived Russians knew about what Putin was doing.
No.
They support him full bore.
Yeah, I think that's a very good that's a very important point for Americans to remember, is to understand how these leaders are seen at home. And Putin's a great example, because another reason that Putin and Xi Jinping are respected is they're seen as standing up to the West, really standing up to America. And people like that. They've had a rough time over the years with particularly both those countries, with Western powers, but especially China. And this kind of resurgent nationalism really plays. And there's some conversations that I have with some of the people in the car who are otherwise pretty liberal. They are aware of what's going on in the world. But some of his assertive nationalism, particularly building islands in the South China Sea, they're quite in favor of. And I think it's important that you know, their view of the West is quite nuanced, and these are not nationalistic hotheads. I've known them for years, and I found that very instructive to me to just sit and listen to see how they saw this and how they saw a country like the United States that in some ways, certainly in terms of the Constitution and the foundations of this political system, they greatly admire. But they see the U.S. as a bully when it comes to foreign policy.
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, I do want to ask you about the leaders, speaking of leaders, in the country in which you are currently residing, Britain, and Brexit. We will get an update on that. It changes minute to minute. So, you know, anything you tell us may change completely by 2 o'clock this afternoon.
It may well.
Frank Langfitt, he's a longtime NPR foreign correspondent. His new book is called The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. He'll be speaking about the book tonight at the Ivy Bookshop. He'll take more of your calls and comments right after a quick break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is NPR London correspondent Frank Langfitt. We're talking about his terrific new book. It's called The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. It's a book that grew out of the imaginative and revealing way that he invented to connect with ordinary Chinese people. He offered free taxi rides to anybody who was interested in exchange for a chance to engage in conversation. If you are interested in engaging Frank Langfitt in conversation, our number here is 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR, and we're streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So today is a big day in British politics.
It is.
You have the day off from reporting on British politics, but give us an update. It looks like at the moment we have three candidates for to replace Theresa May as prime minister.
As leader of the Conservative Party. And so we're down to Boris Johnson, who is far and away the front runner, the former foreign secretary, Jeremy Hunt, the current foreign secretary, and Michael Gove, the environment secretary, if I remember correctly. And soon there'll be another vote, and we'll be down to Boris Johnson and one of those men. Johnson getting the vast majority of votes right now. And then after that, they'll go out for a month on the hustings, and there'll be a final vote of the membership of the party, about 160,000 people, and that person will become the prime minister.
So that'll take place by the end of July?
July 22nd is the date. And this, I guess, from an American perspective, this is like a Republican primary. This is the party voting for the next person to lead the party, and then will become prime minister.
And is there any reason to believe that the next prime minister is going to have any more success than the last one?
No.
In a word.
No, there isn't. So let's look at this. Brexit has already ended the rule of two prime ministers. David Cameron called the election, never intending for Brexit to pass. He was doing this for internal political reasons. He lost control of the process and he had to resign quickly afterwards. Theresa May, 3 years roughly as prime minister, she too has failed to deliver Brexit. Boris Johnson, who is the most likely person to follow on and get the job, he's not a real detail guy. He's charismatic. He charms people. Certainly the Conservative Party members in England like him very much. But we're not seeing some new magic bullet, some great new formula to solve what is essentially kind of an unsolvable Rubik's Cube. Like every kind of combination doesn't really seem to work. And the difficulty, the dilemma for the United Kingdom is how do you leave the European Union, particularly without doing a lot of damage to your own economy? And then how do you solve this problem, this incredible problem on the Irish border?
It is a huge problem.
It is a huge problem. And no one talked about it.
Is this then just a sort of foolish folly, suicide mission for Boris Johnson, assuming he prevails?
Not necessarily. I don't know what's going to happen.
What's in it for him, I wonder? Other than you get to be the prime minister of England.
Well, Tom, you just answered your own question. What everybody, people who follow politics in the United Kingdom would say, Boris Johnson, there's one thing Boris Johnson has always wanted, and that is to be prime minister. How he then takes that job, assuming that he gets it, and pulls this off in some grand fashion when it has defied Parliament and the political class for the last 3 years. That is not clear to me. He says that he can go back to Brussels and he can get a better deal. He's going to threaten to leave without any deal at all. Brussels has lost all patience with the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom, sadly, has really just lost all credibility in Brussels. So the idea that some new prime minister is going to be very deft and clever and be able to get something better out of the EU seems highly unlikely.
The parallels between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump are quite extraordinary.
They are striking.
A former mayor of London, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Yes. Trump, of course, no big fan of the current mayor of London.
No.
But it's also back to China, the subject of your book. Do you place Xi Jinping in this same sort of nationalist panoply? I mean, is he and Trump and Johnson and Viktor Orban in Hungary or Marine Le Pen in France, are they all of a piece? Or is China, just because it's China, off to the side as a separate thing?
Well, I think that there are some parallels. I mean, one thing you can say is these are people who are very focused on identity and identity politics. We talk about the Chinese dream, the rejuvenation of the nation. The other thing is, I would say that they're all nationalistic leaders. And one thing that I find similar that you hear from Brexiteers, Mr. Trump, and from Xi Jinping is a sense also that their countries have not been treated with the respect they should have been treated with. And so in the case of Xi Jinping, as I was mentioning earlier, there was a period of time that's known as the century of national humiliation. He talks about getting respect and taking a central place. President Trump talks about making America great again and returning. And then the Brexiteers talk about we will be free from the shackles of Brussels and we will be great again as well.
Yeah.
On our own as an independent nation, not held down by other countries.
Yeah, not railroaded into doing things by the
union. I can't necessarily say why this is happening in these various countries at the same time, but I would say to some degree it seems to be a backlash against elements of globalization.
And because Britain was unable to get a Brexit deal before the European Parliament elections, they participated.
They did.
And the Brexit Party, which has been, in existence for, a month and a half?
Something like that.
Picked up 6 seats. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, they did extraordinarily well. And that is also a threat to Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party. And he came out after that and said to his own party members, this is a threat to our existence. If we don't get Brexit done, the Brexit Party is going to, in the next general election, is going to run a lot of candidates and they will. And then you could see it's conceivable, Tom, that instead of a two-party system in the United Kingdom, you could see a three-party system with Labour, the Brexit Party, and the Conservative Party. It's already pretty ungovernable right now, and that would be even more challenging, I think.
It's good for you and your beat.
Well,
I don't know.
It has kept me busy. I would say this, though, as someone who grew up in America and believes in the transatlantic alliance that came out of World War II, that has been mostly very successful, NATO, the European Union, helping to largely prevent war on the continent since then, to see the polarization in the countries, the parties themselves splitting apart, the UK pulling away from the European Union, this is not healthy for the West in terms of the shared values. And the people, the countries, the people who benefit most from this are Mr. Putin and Xi Jinping.
Yeah, Mr. Putin, this is the golden age
this
of
is
Mr.
Just,
Putin.
He
Between
could,
what's going on here and what's going on in Europe, he's on a roll.
Yeah, and it's very helpful to him because, of course, it's important to remember his economy is not very good. They don't have a business model like Xi. The Communist Party has a very good business model. They've done remarkable things. Vladimir Putin, everything he needs to do politically is asymmetrical. But to have his rivals in the West actually battling themselves, in some ways undermining the very alliance that Britain and the United States helped build after World War II, it's just beyond his dreams.
Ideal scenario. Frank Langfitt, the book is called The Shanghai Free Taxi. Let's get back to China and a question from Steve who says, two of us went to China in 2006 to visit an exchange student. We attended a church service in a Western hotel with Westerners only. The service bulletin said that they welcome all foreign passport holders. So I asked a member about this. His reply was that though Chinese citizens were welcome, the ballroom where the services were held was monitored and the Chinese citizens were sometimes questioned after attending. He said it was not really about freedom of worship, but about freedom of assembly. It's illegal in China to assemble in the name of anyone except the government.
I think it is about my experience. I attended a church in Beijing as well as Shanghai, and Chinese were not supposed to come. They were not allowed to come to these services. Although I did go to church services on Christmas Eve where lots of mainland Chinese came. And I could tell because I could tell from their accents speaking to them in Mandarin. We had a very interesting experience to answer this question. It's also an anecdote in the book. There was a Christmas pageant at the Shanghai, and it was an international church that I went to in Shanghai. And we had a Christmas pageant, and my son Christopher was a shepherd. And we were sitting there, and in comes somebody from the Religious Affairs Bureau, the Government Religious Affairs Bureau. He sets up a camera and a tripod, and he's videotaping the Christmas pageant. And then I'm watching him the whole time, and after a while, then he just turns, and he starts panning the audience for Chinese faces. So his purpose really wasn't to videotape the pageant. It was to see who was in the audience for the Christmas service.
When it comes to things like censorship, you write that censorship in China is effective not only because the regime makes it difficult to access sensitive information, but also because it fosters an environment in which citizens don't demand such information in the first place.
Well, it's important to remember when you look at sort of the way that they've approached the internet, it's been very clever. The Great Firewall, as we know it, it basically blocks Chinese people from being able to get to sensitive websites, particularly news websites outside of China. But also inside China, the internet is actually enormously entertaining, and Chinese social media apps are incredibly helpful. I'm on WeChat. I find, just in terms of practicality, there's a very effective Chinese intranet. So if you're living in China, there's lots of access to entertainment, which is where a lot of people would spend their time here in the United States. And so they are able to focus on lots of different things that don't have any sensitive content. So it's very easy to be distracted. It's not like they're just cut off from the internet. The Chinese intranet, essentially, is very rich. And so people focus on entertainment and Chinese news and things like that, and often will not go outside. Most people don't have virtual private networks, which allows you to leap over the Great Firewall of China. And so a lot of people are, I think, very satisfied, or largely satisfied in China with what they have in terms of the internet that's available.
In terms of Xi Jinping, you mentioned his political abilities. So here he and Mr. Trump appear to be, you know, locked in a trade war. The effects of the tariffs, we learned just today that China has raised its tariffs on U.S. goods, and it's lowered tariffs mm-hmm. on goods from other countries, you know, creating other markets. And this is, of course, something that many of the farmers here in America, et cetera, are very concerned about. But in terms of these guys who have spent a good bit of time together now, the two of them, what's your take on Xi's mastery of the negotiating process? I mean, we have Mr. Trump who's bragging all the time about his mastery of his. What do you think about Xi?
Well, one thing about Xi that's very interesting is I think he did underestimate Mr. Trump. I think when the president came into office, a lot of China watchers, I think, also underestimated him and thought that Xi Jinping and the Chinese government would just charm him to death and flatter him and he would roll over. In fact, he's turned out to be the most confrontational president with China that we've had in my memory. And he also did this at a time when the Chinese economy was vulnerable. Growth has been slowing for many years. There's way too much debt, so they were deleveraging. And so there's less money floating around to keep the economy running. So he actually kind of had President Xi where he wanted him. And the thing is now, from talking to some of the folks in the book, I'm still in touch with them. I was talking to them last week. People are feeling the effects of the trade war. Ashley is in investment banking. She is having a hard time being able to manage assets from state-owned companies. But it's not tough enough on either side for anybody to, I think, cut a deal right now.
Frank Langfitt is the author of The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Frank Langfitt will be speaking about the book tonight at 7 o'clock at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in North Baltimore. Come to our website, wipr.org/midday, for a link to more information about that event. This has been a delight to read the book and to chat with you about it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's the Midday News Wrap. We'll have a review of Disaster as well. That's at Cockpit in Court from theater critic J. Wynn Russick, and hope you can join us for that tomorrow on Midday. Lunch today was provided by Eddie's of Roland Park, presenting outdoor movie nights this summer, including Wallace and Gromit on July 17th and 18th, and Jaws on July 24th and 25th. Bring a blanket or a chair for movie screenings under the stars as part of Eddie's of Roland Park's 75th anniversary celebration. You can find details at eddiesofrolandpark.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.